Ayes. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Hartley presiding. All other business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley. On my right is Judge Greenberg, and on my left is Judge Toth. We're here today for the matter of Percivelli v. Wilkie, docket number 17-3766. The issue before the court is whether the board's September 2017 decision finding no Q as a matter of law in a 1971 RO decision that denied an increased eval for a left knee condition was arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion, or not in accord with law. Would counsel for the parties please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Kenny Dohakis for Mr. Percivelli.
Thank you, Mr. Dohakis.
Good morning. It is the court. My name is Sheree Marcus. I'm the counsel for the secretary. With me at counsel's table is Deputy Chief Counsel Christopher Wallace.
Thank you, Ms. Marcus. Are you all ready to proceed? Okay. Each party has 30 minutes to present their arguments. Mr. Dohakis, do you want to reserve any time?
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes.
Okay. Please make that happen, Don. Mr. Dohakis, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. First, I want to start by clarifying our position again. Our opening brief erroneously asked for the wrong relief, and as explained in our reply brief, we're asking the court to rule that the VA never had an official policy or interpretation of Section 4.71A and the various diagnostic codes for the knee, and whether separate ratings under those diagnostic codes are precluded under Section 4.14. We argue that the board's error in this regard should be reversed, and then that the case is remanded so that the board may address the merits of the Q motion. So in 1971, Mr. Percivelli filed a claim for an increase in his left knee. At the time, he was service-connected for residuals of a meniscus injury and under Diagnostic Code 5259. The VA denied this claim despite evidence indicating that there may be arthritis. He filed a motion.
Counsel, let me just interrupt for a minute. So your position is that the board did not make a merits determination on the Q motion?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the first step of determining whether there was Q is whether there was an error of fact or law. Why can't the board's decision be viewed as addressing that first part, that is, the merits?
I think that when you look at the language that the board used, they said that there is no legal basis for a Q motion. And I think that it's possible that the board may have reached the first, whether there was an error in law. But the way that I read the board decision, they never really got to the Q because the board said that the law changed. And under 3.105, a change in the interpretation of the law cannot be Q, and so that they never really reached whether there was an error in law. Rather, the board ruled that the law changed with Esteban and the general counsel's opinion in 1997, 23-97. And so because there was a change in law, there is no Q at all.
Okay, but you admit that it could go... It could have been seen that they undertook the first step of a Q analysis.
I don't necessarily agree with that, Your Honor. I don't think that they ever reached whether the ruling in 1971 was erroneous in any way. The way that I read the board decision was that the board said that because there was a change in law, and they looked specifically at the time, they never really reached the time period of 1971 other than to, you know, recite the facts of what went on, the procedural history. The ruling from the board was that the law changed and therefore there can be no Q attack.
Okay, thank you.
So Mr. Percivelli specifically argued that the plain language of the law in 1971, a plain reading of the regulations, the diagnostic codes, required separate ratings for arthritis with and the meniscus injury. So looking at the regulations, the language of the regulations are the same today as they were in 1971. 4.59 requires the VA to rate with a minimum compensation, compensable rating, actually painful joints. And 4.71A mandates under Diagnostic Code 5003 that arthritis is to be rated based on limitation of motion of the involved joint, but if it is non-compensable, it receives a 10% rating. The Secretary asserts today that prior to 1997, the VA interpreted these regulations to provide only one rating for the knee joint. He points specifically to General Counsel Opinion 23-97 as support for this assertion. However, the General Counsel Opinion does not say this. Instead, and I think this is the most important language in that opinion, the Council Opinion specifically says, and I'm quoting here, VA knows of no formal position taken by the Veterans Benefit Administration on this issue.
And I read your argument about that. So how does that – I understand what you – that you may view the fact that VA had no formal position as helping you, but does that get you to Q? I mean, for Q, wouldn't you need to show that not only was there no formal position, but that the position the action that VA took in 1971, whichever avenue it was, to rate separately or not, was undebatably an error?
Well, Your Honor, the board, again, has not reached the merits of the Q. And so what we're really asking today is to allow the board to address the Q allegation. The board said we're not going to consider it because the law changed and you cannot have any Q, so we're not going to even let you into the building. All we're asking is that you open the door and let us in the building so that we can have a chance for the board to address the argument. I think addressing the Q motion at this stage in the litigation is premature, one, because the board has not looked at it, and two, because we don't really know what the facts and the law, how the board views what the regional office should have done in 1971. And so when there is no position, formal position, then we're stuck with what does the law actually say. And that's what guides the board in determining whether there was clear and unmistakable error. What does the law say? And what did the law require in 1971? If the VA had a formal position, whether through some general counsel opinion or some other instructions to their regional office, then that normally would guide them. But there was no formal position, so really the regional offices were kind of doing whatever they wanted based on that individual rater's interpretation of the regulations.
So you're not aware of any manual provision at the time that gave some guidance as to 4.14 or 503 or 5257? Or any combination thereof.
No, Your Honor. I'm not aware of anything. And I'm taking the Secretary at his word that there was no formal position, at least in 1997, and looking back. And I think that he would be in a better position at that stage to tell us than we would today.
Now, in terms of characterizing your position, is your position that the board intentionally or unintentionally mischaracterized or misinterpreted your arguments before the board, in that they were looking at your argument in light of Esteban and the GC opinion and decisions or opinions that occurred in the 90s when they should have limited themselves to what was on the record in the 70s, what was on the record and what the law was in the
70s? Yes, Your Honor. I think that the board did misinterpret the Q allegations first proffered by Mr. Percivali. The way that I read the board decision was that the board understood him to argue that because of General Counsel Opinion 23-97, that somehow should relate back to 1971 and undo the prior decision. And that's not what he argued. Mr. Percivali argued that under the regulations, the VA was required to rate separately. And as an example, he used the General Counsel Opinion as evidence to support his decision that, you know, look, the VA has already said this later, granted, but this is confirming evidence that our position is correct.
Let me ask you a question. Is there enough in the record? How, your client is getting up there in age, isn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think we have an obligation to consider that fact. But is there enough in the record for us to reverse and send it back rather than remand, and he's now caught in the administrative web again?
Unfortunately, Your Honor,
I want him to live long enough to see an actual result, with all due respect. It's your client. You're asking for a remand. But my question is there enough here where we so inclined to reverse the decision and order judgment entered at a certain percentage?
Unfortunately, there's not, Your Honor, because the medical evidence needs to be addressed first by the board, whether the X-ray shows arthritis or not. The board never discussed that in any way at all. And that, unfortunately, is a fact that requires the board.
Are there X-rays?
There are X-rays, Your Honor. None of them specifically say arthritis. I think the...
What's the basis? As I understand it, you're seeking a specific rating for the arthritis.
A 10% rating, Your Honor.
Well, what's the basis for that?
Again, under 4.59, requiring minimum compensable rating for painful joints, and 5003, which requires a 10% rating when with limitation of motion. Now, the record does show limitation of motion, and it does show an X-ray which indicates, it doesn't say arthritis, but it uses some words that seem to indicate arthritis. Of course, I would argue that it absolutely shows arthritis, but the board hasn't addressed that, so I'm not sure that there's enough specificity in the medical evidence to support a ruling at this stage.
Well, what about the argument you're making that the secretary is obligated to impose a minimum of a 10% rating, and that's all you're asking for here, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that...
So what more medical evidence needs to be supplied to the board to have entered if they had correctly applied the regulation, as you argue they didn't? What more has to be submitted?
Get
the 10%.
I think at this stage, none. Obviously, with the Q, there can't be new evidence, but just in the interpretation of that evidence, I think the evidence supports painful limited motion of the knee in addition to the meniscus. The question, though, I think, is whether the painful motion is from the meniscus injury and those residuals, or if there's arthritis with painful motion.
And that requires a separate medical opinion?
That requires,
in your view, for the board to make the two separate determinations.
It requires the board to determine whether if the X-ray shows arthritis, then that alone should be enough, in our view, to award a 10% rating because under 5003 and 4.59.
And that's what you want?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what we want.
And you seem to be conceding in that exchange you just had with Judge Greenberg that it's not clear whether he had arthritis at the time, but isn't that problematic? under our queue. I mean, if we were just looking at service connection, that wouldn't be an issue. We could send it back for some fact-finding or adjudicative finding. But given that this is an acute arena, is that a problem for your client?
Allow me to clarify my statement. I believe the evidence fully supports the presence of arthritis. The x-ray supports the presence of arthritis.
Undebatably.
Undebatably, in the way that we read the evidence. However, the issue is whether the board has to make that determination first or if the court can do that. And I believe that the jurisdiction of the court does not allow them, does not allow you to rule initially on that fact issue.
So how does our, let's say we find an error in what the board did, in either not, in or in either maybe misunderstanding what you were arguing, or in some other way, we just find an error. So under Sanders and Simmons, we do have an obligation to consider whether that error was harmless or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what would, if you were writing our harmless error analysis, what would you say? A rough outline is fine. I mean, given the factual, I mean, not. I just point out, just to frame my question, that there seem to be several factual uncertainties that don't quite meet up with, don't seem to quite meet up with the standard for Q. That is, not only was there no diagnosis or mention of arthritis in the x-ray report or in the July 71 exam, but he had very slight instability as opposed to slight instability. He had a non-compensable amount of flexion loss with pain on activity. So those are things that, you know, so how would you write our harmless error analysis? Those things are, I think, in any view, detrimental to the Q motion.
Your Honor, I would say that under the obligation of the court to consider harmless error, that it, well, first I would argue that there's not enough information there to make a ruling whether the evidence goes one way or the other. But if the court's looking at the evidence specifically and finding facts under their obligation to consider harmless error, that the trying to figure the best way to term this, the evidence, rather the board has not given the court enough to go off of, and I would caution that the deciding facts that were never considered by the board in any fashion, I think is far more goes far beyond what the spirit of the harmless error is.
Are you saying that we're not in a position to know whether the error was harmless or it was harmful?
It was, well, my position is it was harmful because...
Why don't you stick to it?
Yes, Your Honor. The error was harmful because the x-ray evidence shows arthritis. And it doesn't specifically say arthritis, but the terms that it used are synonymous with arthritis. And so because of that, the board has an obligation to consider whether that arthritis and the limitation of motion would provide a 10% rating separate from in combination with the meniscus injury.
And your fallback or alternative position is that there isn't enough there. If you don't believe that, ladies and gentlemen of the court, the other position is that there isn't enough there to make a determination as to whether it's harmless error.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Hoggins, I have a question, sort of I'm going to follow up on sort of the line of questioning Judge Bartley asked, which is, I mean, there's sort of a central tension in your argument, which is on the one hand, to proceed, you need to suggest that this is not a change in the law. But ultimately, to prevail, you would need to show that there was an incorrect reading of the law, right? And so as I understand it, it would seem that prior to the GC opinion, there's a sort of range of application that could be applied, yet no sort of overriding interpretation of how to actually make that application. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, there was no official, this is how you rate this particular situation under these facts. There was nothing like that from the Veterans Benefit Administration. The way that I view it is that each rater was kind of doing whatever they were doing, and on sometimes they would give them a separate rating, and sometimes they wouldn't. But there was no official, other than the official position that 414 precludes pyramiding, there was no official position whether this is specifically pyramiding or not.
Don, would you add 5 minutes, please?
And so, I realize this would be a merits determination, and this is a little bit beyond where, but what then would be the error of law? What would be the clear and unmistakable error of law?
Your Honor, the error in law was that the regulations, 4701A, Diagnostic Codes 5003 and 5259, in combination with 4.59, which mandates, those both mandate compensable ratings for arthritis or actually painful joints with limitation of motion. The clear error is that by the application of those regulations required the VA to assign a separate 10% rating in addition
to... Right, and individual raters were applying that too restrictively.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the problem is it was never a court decision showing this is how this should be interpreted. It was largely VA sort of sua sponte, or was it Esteban, this is what you're saying, clarified it, and then VA codified that change?
Esteban clarified how to determine whether pyramiding exists, right. But Esteban specifically...
No, I get it. Esteban didn't make any holdings. It didn't sort of make any pronouncements. It was a direct appeal just adjudicating that case.
Yes, Your Honor. There were no court holdings on the issue. The general counsel opinion was prompted by, I think, a couple remands from the court asking about this particular situation. And so the VA on their own, without any analysis, I guess, from the court, determined that this is what the law requires. And again, in the general counsel opinion, they said the plain language, the plain meaning of these regulations require that separate ratings be assigned for arthritis and meniscus injury because they're separate disabilities.
So your point would be whatever the operative interpretation or non-interpretation prior to 97, it was applied incorrectly.
Yes, Your Honor. And the law has always said this because, as the Secretary said, the plain meaning of the terms requires separate ratings.
I just have one last question. I mean, the Board's decision seems to hedge a bit as to what your argument is or how, you know, on the one hand it says, I think on page 4, that you've not provided any evidence that VA had an interpretation prior to the in 1971, and then later says that you're arguing for retroactive effect. What's the actual error, the legal error in the board?
In the board's decision, Your Honor? The board, the legal error is, first, that there was a change in law in 1997. And again, there was no change in law because there was no prior position, so you can't change something that never existed. And that error required the board to essentially say there is no valid legal cue argument. And so the board's error is their decision was arbitrary, capricious, and not in accordance with the law.
Okay, so your reading of what would be a change in law, it would necessitate a sort of renunciation of an earlier existing interpretation or rule or something, as opposed to just sort of saying this is a permissible range and here's maybe we'll clarify what the best reading is without necessarily rejecting other less.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that a change in law typically would look like this is how we read it. It could go this way or this way, but we the VA say that it's instead of A, it's B. And I think that would be or this is how we have directed before. However, we look at it again. These were unofficial, maybe in an M21 provision like the VA.
So a change in law need to go from A to B. It can't go from nothing to A, right? I mean, it can't be a sort of first impression interpretation.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
That's your position.
There can be no change if there was. It has to change from something. It can't be nothing and then become something as a change. They have to actually change their position, change their interpretation. The VA has to have some interpretation initially that needs to be changed, that's incorrect or clarified.
Are you aware of any of our case law or Federal Circuit case law that in a Q context we have affirmed where the board didn't address the veteran's Q argument? And in fact seem to misunderstand the argument to some extent?
I can't give any specific examples, Your Honor. Something in the back of my brain kind of perks up, but I think I've read, at least in memo decisions, I'm not aware of any off the top of my head, any panel decisions, but where they would say, yes, you incorrectly applied the law, but it was harmless because of whatever reason. And there's something recent that I know I'm overlooking, and I am out of time now. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Dajokas. Ms. Marcus, you may go ahead.
May it please the Court, the Secretary in this matter is seeking affirmance of the Board's decision on appeal that found no clear and unmistakable error with a final 1971 regional office determination. That determination found that an increased rating greater than 10% was not warranted based on the evidence then of record. At that time, appellant was service-connected for residuals of a medial meniscectomy. He was rated 10% under Diagnostic Code 5259. And no further increase was warranted according to that determination. Appellant did not appeal. It became final. And then this stems from a 2015 motion seeking to revise that final determination based on clear and unmistakable error. And again, when we're talking about a collateral attack on a final regional office determination, it is appellant who bears, as this court coined the term, a very heavy burden of persuasion to indicate that there was not only error, but that error is indisputable, that no reasonable minds could differ that the error occurred, and had it not occurred, it would manifestly change the outcome. Secretary at the outset indicates that Helen's argument as a whole is a red herring. It is a hypothetical exercise. Because to even reach appellant's argument, we would have to go back in time and directly review the 1971 regional office determination, directly review the evidence that was before that regional office, which is simply not appropriate in the context of a Q setting.
But we do, we have to review the board decision here. I mean, the board decision staked out ground as to what constitutes a change of law, right? I mean, that could be correct or not.
Correct, Your Honor. So if we look directly at the board decision, the board denied this Q motion based on 20.1403E of the regulation, saying that a change in regulatory interpretation cannot form the basis of a Q motion. Now, appellant phrases his argument different ways. He says that VA never had a formal position, that the law never changed, that the diagnostic codes read the same way. But appellant misses the mark. The point here, the pertinent inquiry here, as is settled in case law at the Federal Circuit and here, is that how was the law understood to mean at the time of the 1971 regional office determination?
And what evidence do you have of how the law was understood to mean at the time?
Well, that's what makes this case kind of odd. it's the Secretary's position that appellant hasn't even proven indisputably that this error, this alleged error, actually occurred. Usually you would go first to the regional office, the final determination, and see what was said, what was done. Here it's not even clear that Diagnostic Code 5003 was reasonably raised by the record, that separate ratings were reasonably raised or triggered, that there was even an error, an alleged error of not awarding separate ratings. It didn't seem that it was even raised by the evidence of record.
So he has pointed to a variety of symptoms that appear to fall under different diagnostic codes.
Right. So if we look, you're right, Your Honor, and if we look at the regional office determination as an implicit denial of separate ratings, although that's not very clear, what is clear is that the regional office looked at the knee diagnostic codes and found that none of them would support a rating higher than 10% and therefore denied the claim. But if we were to hypothetically look at that regional office determination as an implicit denial of separate ratings, then what is the pertinent inquiry is how was the law understood to mean at the time, not the exact words as they were written there compared to how they're written now. And even Jordan v. Nicholson and most recently George v. Wilkie, this court has held that even if there's a precedential decision that says how the law has always meant, that decision cannot be retroactively applied in the context of a Q claim. Now the board points out, as far as how do we interpret the law back then, the board points to a few things. They point to 4.14, they point to Esteban, and they point to that 1997 GC opinion.
How can they point to Esteban whenever you just said that in order to interpret what the law meant at the time, they point to Esteban. Esteban was a good 20 years later than this RO decision.
Right. So the point of...
So what's the point of referring to Esteban?
Great question, Your Honor. So the point of pointing to Esteban is that it was two decades after the 1971 decision, and that was the first time the court articulated that pyramiding is not prohibitive if the pertinent inquiry is the symptomatology and whether they're overlapping versus manifestly separate and distinct. Now, what's important...
Just if I may interrupt you. So at the time in 1971, I note that at the current time, there is a regulation that I believe was on the books in 71, 4.25B.
Your Honor, that was not on the books in
4.25B was not.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I was about to get there.
Okay.
So 4.14 was, the pyramiding regulation was there, which basically said that evaluation of the same disability under various diagnoses is to be avoided. It wasn't until 1989, almost two decades later, that 4.25B was added in, which indicated that disabilities arising from a single disease entity could be rated separately. And in fact, arthritis was used as an example. That provision did not exist in 1971.
Uh-huh. And when they added it, was there any explanation in the Federal Register as to why it was added? Or?
I looked, Your Honor. I didn't see any particular. It was in the context of the combined ratings table, so it's not abundantly clear, but that was definitely the focus in Esteban, looking at those two provisions. What's interesting about Esteban, too, is that it started off as a summary affirmance. The court granted the Secretary summary affirmance, saying that the separate disability ratings would constitute impermissible pyramiding, and that is the way that it was interpreted. Even before Esteban, in the very short history of the court before that time, you see Brady v. Brown. I found a Memdeck, Sanders v. Principi, which was in 91-1594, where the court was affirming board decisions that rated knee disabilities under one diagnostic code, even in the situation where there was also a diagnosis of arthritis, slight instability, muscle impairment. The court had found that that would be duplication and pyramiding of benefits. But in Esteban, when it went to panel, that's when the examination between 4.14 and 4.25B, the court found for the first time that, okay, well, the pertinent inquiry then is let's look at the manifestations and the symptomatology. Are they overlapping or are they separate? That's simply not the fact, the context of the body of law that existed in 1971. So we can see that it was at a minimum, it was a permissible reading of the regulations to not afford separate disability ratings for one service-connected knee disability. And under Berger v. Brown, that's all that's needed. As long as what the RO did is plausible in the context of the body of the law that existed at that time, it cannot form a basis of a Q motion to introduce new interpretations of the regulations. In fact, the 1997 GC opinion was not the last, definitely not the last to address NIDA's diagnostic codes, and neither was Esteban with regard to these separate readings. The NIDA diagnostic codes have gone through a long evolution, including as recently as Lyles v. Shulkin in 2017. So it's very clear that the interpretation of the regulations was not based on what the diagnostic code said, but the context of the body of law that existed at that time. And for those reasons, Your Honor, that in the context of a Q claim, appellant cannot base his motion on what the law currently says or how the law would currently be interpreted.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it sounds like you're misreading what the appellant was arguing before the board, just like the board did, because in his, I guess it was an attachment to the Form 9, he specifically said in August 17, we are not, and this is a lay person arguing, or a lay representative or lay agent, we are not arguing the 1997 GC opinion or any VA rules that came after the 71 rating decision. We contend the law has always permitted a separate evaluation can be applied based on instability, et cetera. So I mean, I get like where you're going, but your starting point seems to be completely off, I have to say, because you're focusing on everything that happened after and his, you know, after and how, you know, it's been interpreted, you know, up until Lyles. But, I mean, really, his argument is that at the time, if VA had properly read 4.14 and the regulations that precede 4.71A, including seemingly 440 and 445 and 459, that if it had been properly done as the regs provide, that he would have gotten more than the 10% under more than one diagnostic code. So just it's just like you were like spiraling out about like what's happened, and you know, this is not the only GC opinion. Yeah, we know that there were like three other ones around the time that were talking about how many DCs you could get rated under. But I mean, under his view, that's all irrelevant. His view is that forget about all of that. At the time of the 71 decision, if someone had bothered to read the regs properly, well, even 4.14 was just saying, listen, don't rate the same thing twice. He's basically saying, well, that obviously didn't apply in 71 because I was, you know, if they had rated my arthritis and instability separately, that wouldn't have constituted rating the same thing twice.
Your Honor, the reason I went through all that, I do believe it is relevant to the inquiry here because appellant is missing the mark. In the context of a Q motion, we're looking at the context of the body of the law that existed. It's not whether it was a permissible reading of the interpretation, but what did the RO do? Did the RO read the law incorrectly? And if there's a plausible interpretation the way the RO applied the facts to the law, then you can't form a Q basis based on, you know, subsequent changes in the way we understand the law. The way the agency understood the law at the time, there was only 4.14. There wasn't a 4.25.
And you're saying that that was plausible, reading 4.14 as preventing him from getting an evaluation under two separate diagnostic codes. So let's look at 4.14 and tell me where that's a plausible reading.
Okay,
that bar is a plausible rating.
Sure, Your Honor. I do want to clarify. It's not that I'm saying that it would prevent separate ratings ever. I'm saying it was a plausible interpretation of that regulation at the time that one service-connected disability should be rated with one diagnostic code. It wasn't until 4.25B was added, and then Esteban clarified that it was the pertinent inquiry was the symptomatology and the manifestation stemming from the disability, even if it's just one disability. Again, this is not this case in any case. This is not the case here because in 1971 we didn't have a diagnosis of arthritis. It wasn't reasonably raised. The diagnostic code 5003 wasn't reasonably raised. To even reach this analysis in even a hypothetical sense, we would have to reweigh the evidence as it was before that adjudicator here, which we cannot directly or indirectly review the 1971 reading decision.
I mean, I take it your word that that would have been a plausible reading in 1971, but also, I mean, Mr. DeHakis argues so would rating it separately would have been plausible, just in the absence of any generalized interpretation.
Well, the interpretations are shown in, I mean, again, these are from the 1990s just because of the history of the court. It didn't go back to 1971. That's kind of what all we have to interpret these regulations. But Brady v. Brown, Sanders v. Principe, even at the summary affirmance that Esteban had put out even before they sent it to panel, basically said that within the statutory language of 38 U.S.C. Section 1155, the idea of compensating a claimant twice for the same impairment is to be avoided. It's considered pyramiding of benefits. So this was the way the court interpreted these provisions as well, along with 4.14. And the court specifically was affirming board decisions that declined to award separate ratings and had specific pyramiding analyses.
Right, but I mean, so what I'm struggling with, I don't know if my colleagues are, is sort of what I mentioned to Mr. DeHakis earlier, is both of your arguments are sort of at cross purposes with each other in the sense of you know, to even, you know, the board rules that this would be basically be, is based on a change of the law, that the reg obviated whatever happened before, and that that simply can't sustain a Q motion, right? On the other hand, if there was a range of permissible constructions that then the law clarified, that would not be a retroactive effect. So that's the board ruling. Now, on the merits, everything flips because you need an error. So you'd have to point to something that would have been erroneous in the earlier decision. And I'm just wondering, how do we work through? I mean, this seems to me to be the sort of prejudice piece, maybe, at the end of it versus the
yes,
kind of
Your
threshold
Honor,
issue. Like, how do we sort of, Judge Bartley asked about this, so how do we work through this?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what I was going to say. Even if the court finds that the board should have gone the extra step and decided one way or the other whether the error existed, the court does have to look at the doctrine of prejudicial harm and can look at, even if there's relevant determinations that the board didn't make and the court finds should have made, we can look at those relevant determinations for the purpose of figuring out whether there is any prejudicial harm. And here, it's just not undebatable that Diagnostic Code 5003 was reasonably raised here, that appellant had a diagnosis of arthritis, that he would have been entitled to a separate rating if that was the way the regulations were interpreted back then. So the alleged error, even if it did occur, is simply non-prejudicial, simply because he has not shown, has not met that extra heavy burden of persuasion that there is an indisputable error that would have manifestly changed the outcome here. Does that answer?
So I asked the appellant this earlier. Just in terms of the court's essential fairness doctrine, Thurber and like cases, are you aware of a case, a Q motion, that the board denied and we affirmed, where the board had not addressed the appellant's Q argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is what happened in Lamb v. Peek. The court or the board did not reach the Q motion at all, and the court said that it doesn't matter anyway because we have to look at the law as it was understood at the time of the decision, and therefore his argument can't be considered because this is a Q claim based on the retroactive application of the law. And so I believe that's what happened in Lamb v. Peek.
Yeah, but here we've agreed, haven't we, that it does not involve retroactive application of the law. Or does the Secretary disagree with that? Because as I read, it wasn't Mr. DeHakis's submission. It was the agent before the board. Said we're not arguing the 1997 opinion or any rules after, we contend that the law at the time of 71, regardless of what happened after, if you had read it, it would have, he says, permitted, but any, which I don't know was a wise choice of words, but that separate ratings were fine if you read all of the regs properly. So that doesn't involve any retroactivity argument.
Right. I suppose I would disagree with that, Your Honor, in the sense that the pertinent inquiry isn't whether the law changed, but again, how was it understood at the time? So it's still the Secretary's position that it was not understood at that time to, you know, that one service-connected need, residuals for medial meniscectomy would have triggered separate ratings or that they would have been permissible. But the answer
But just to stop you there, so, and what are you pointing to at the time of the 71 decision? There were no manual provisions. I had asked the appellant this. Were there any manual provisions about separate evals for different manifestations?
No, Your Honor. I was looking at it merely from the context of the body of law that applied at that time, which did not include 4.25B, which did not include the court clarification that came later on in the 90s, those sort of things. And then also, Your Honor, I found many examples of denial of separate ratings with specific pyramiding analysis. I couldn't find a single example when the agency had ever awarded separate ratings under these diagnostic codes.
Okay, good. Then let's get to looking at what 4.14 said at the time. It's the same now as it was then? Is that true? Okay.
At the time.
So if we can just go over it sentence by sentence, although I think we'll agree that the first and last sentences, and particularly the last part of the last sentence, are the key ones.
Okay, so the first sentence says the evaluation of the same disability under various diagnoses is to be avoided. Now, that does not suggest that it's never possible, but what we're contending is that in the time of the 1971 decision is that the way that was interpreted is that it was a permissible reading to not award separate ratings because of the pyramiding regulation.
And so you're reading same disability to include different disabilities?
Again, this is sort of a hypothetical because in 1971 there was only one service-connected disability, residuals of medial meniscectomy. There was no other disability. So, again, I don't see the error that the RO committed, but I believe that the agency, the way the agency applied this regulation is that if there was one service-connected disability, the RO would have looked at all appropriate diagnostic codes and awarded whichever one would have been most favorable.
And, okay, so looking at the evaluation of the same disability under various diagnoses is to be avoided. So you're interpreting the same disability, the word disability, to mean service-connected disability?
The service-connected disability, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And let's look at the last sentence.
Both the use of manifestations not resulting from service-connected disease or injury and establishing the service-connected evaluation and the evaluation of the same manifestation under different diagnoses are to be avoided.
And so the first part of that sentence obviously is not relevant here, but the evaluation of the same manifestation under different diagnoses is to be avoided. How do you read that? How do you read that, and how should someone have read that in 1971?
The evaluation of the same manifestation under different diagnoses are to be avoided. I'm not entirely sure without it a specific case. I mean, if we look at the particular case in 1971, I suppose if appellant had meniscus abnormalities, but it was diagnosed different ways, you couldn't award disability ratings for that meniscus abnormality under just because there was different diagnoses addressing it.
But here he had laxity, terms that are synonymous with arthritis used in an X-ray report, and pain on motion or with activity.
Okay, and then this would say that the evaluation of the same manifestation under different diagnoses are to be avoided. We're not really supposed to be directly reviewing that 1971 decision, or the evidence was there, because, you know, you could weigh the evidence that way. You could also look at the 1971 VA examination report saying, well, they had that X-ray, and the examiner declined to diagnose arthritis. So saying that the X-ray had words synonymous with arthritis is sort of weighing the evidence, which is outside of a Q context. The point here is there really isn't an indisputable error in that decision where we could point and say he was clearly and unmistakably entitled to two separate ratings, and there's also nothing that indicates that this was an impermissible reading of the regulation in 1971 to not permit separate ratings, although that's not even what happened here. Regional office didn't make a determination one way or the other about separate ratings. Secretary's position that it wasn't reasonably raised. It's a red herring in this case. But certainly the pertinent inquiry is whether the interpretation is a plausible one in the context of the body of law. And I think given that there was no 4.25B, there was no subsequent, there was no clarifications, there was no Esteban, that certainly it was a plausible interpretation to look at this case, residuals of a medial meniscectomy, and award one disability rating.
Okay, but to get back to your suggestion that Lamb was a case where the board misunderstood the appellant's argument and therefore didn't address it, and the board denied and the court affirmed.
I think maybe I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. I thought you were asking for an example of a situation where the Q motion was not reached on the merits and then the court affirmed anyway, and that was what happened in Lamb. Granted, it's a little bit of the opposite of what is happening here. The court affirmed because they found no prejudicial harm based on 20.1403E. Here, the board denied the Q motion based on 20.1403E, and I think you're asking for an example where the court found that the merits should have been reached, but there was no prejudicial harm. That way, I don't know of any case. But Lamb v. Peek, the court did reach a Q motion that the board hadn't addressed at all.
And in this context, then, and not the Lamb context, then, is there any essential fairness problem where the board actually didn't address the appellant's, where the board didn't address the appellant's argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because in this case, it's still the Secretary's contention that there's no prejudicial harm here, and that in the Q context that the appellant bears that extra heavy burden of persuasion. And because that burden of persuasion is on appellant, I don't think that that doctrine comes into play here, because it is, you know, just it's a very narrow standard of review. We're just looking at the board decision to see if there was a satisfactory explanation, or the board acted arbitrary, capricious, and not in accordance with law. But here, it's the burden is on the appellant, and I, for the reasons stated, we don't see any prejudicial harm.
And if, as you're stating, the idea of providing separate evaluations wasn't known to VA adjudicators, it was like not even a thought.
It just wasn't the way we did it.
When did it first present to VA then?
No, it's not that it wasn't presented. It's just that's not the way they were evaluated back then, and you see that pattern through. I mean, the most clear we have is in the 1990s. when the board decision started to be reviewed by this court on a more regular basis, and you see those affirmances from the court where they're affirming the board's decision not to award separate ratings and where there's a specific pyramiding analysis. In this case, the regional office didn't make a specific pyramiding analysis. So again, we're speculating that that's what happened here. But there's no point in time where it was prohibited. It's just not, it was a permissible reading to not award separate ratings for the same service-connected disability. And given the facts of this case, it was a plausible, the RO's determination was plausible, and there was no indisputable error here.
Okay. In DAV versus Gober, one of the service groups, I believe, argued that 20.1403E was unfair because some interpretations of statutes and regs were never aren't published, and the Federal Circuit found that was not a problem because VA has a rule that substantive interpretations have to be published. Is that a problem here?
Not in acute context, Your Honor, because again, the appellant has to plead his Q motion with specificity, and here he hasn't alleged an error that is so undebatable that it would have manifestly changed the outcome. So it's not a problem in the Q context simply because of the shift in the burden of persuasion here. And also, we're, you know, again, this is not this case. 1971, the regional office did not have, you know, a thorough pyramiding analysis or anything. It's, we're speculating that that even happened here.
Yeah. You're making the argument, but I'm more interested in what did the regional office know, or all the regional offices know in 1971 as to how to apply these regulations?
Ms. Marcus, before you reply, Don, could you add 5 minutes? Thank you.
What was the process of training or education of the regional office personnel in applying this regulation in 1971 so that we can be sure that there was no clear and unmistakable error on the part of this particular regional office in applying this regulation?
I'm certainly not prepared to. I can't give you any particularities of how they were trained.
Why not?
In 1971, I don't have those data points. I mean, certainly we could find that data. I mean, we...
Well, let me see if I can understand it. You have general counsel letters, opinions.
Nothing.
You've got the regulation itself. Did the M21 or some predecessor of it exist in 1971 as a training device for regional offices?
Yes, I believe they were called, I can't recall off the top of my head what they were called, but it wasn't an M21, it weren't fast letters, but there was something else. I did search through them. There was nothing that specifically discussed Diagnostic Code 5257 and 5003, but the point here is that whether we look at the 1971 regional office determination in the context of the body of law that existed and the facts that were presented at that time, and whether there was clear and unmistakable error, and given what we're looking at, there just simply doesn't seem to be an undebatable error that occurred, especially given the fact that the facts don't indisputably show arthritis or that Diagnostic Code 5003 was even raised. Looking through the evolution of the way the knee diagnostic codes are now interpreted is helpful, and it shows that it was not the agency's interpretation, or at bare minimum, it wasn't clear that separate ratings would have been warranted under these diagnostic codes. And saying that it's not clear certainly doesn't equate to undebatable and indisputable error.
Thank you, Ms. Marcus.
Okay. If there are no further questions, the Secretary maintains that the board decision should be affirmed based on the pleadings and what was discussed today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Your Honor. I have obviously a few points. I want to first start out with the Secretary's assertion that there was a plausible basis for not assigning separate ratings, and I think that that is incorrect. Even though 4.25 may not have been in existence at the time, when you look at the regulations that were, it is very clear that a separate rating should have been assigned where arthritis is present. First, 4.14 directs that evaluation of the same disability under separate diagnosis is to be avoided. And then, and the last sentence again, as Judge Farley pointed out, that the same manifestation under different diagnoses are to be avoided. We're not talking about the same disability here or the same manifestations. What we're talking about is separate disability, and from the medical evidence, it's undebatable that limitation of motion existed. It's also undebatable that Mr. Percivali had a symptomatic post-meniscus surgery. And it's also undebatable that arthritis existed. The x-ray shows joint space narrowing, which is, again, synonymous with arthritis. So under 4.59, which was in effect at the time, this regulation directs the intent of the schedule is to recognize painful motion as productive of disability. And so what this regulation does is it mandates that where there's painful motion, that equates disability. The painful motion is separate from the post-meniscus rating that Mr. Percivali was in receipt of. And then again, under the Diagnostic Code 5003, x-ray findings will be rated on the basis of limitation of motion, again referring back to the same type of manifestations for a disability described in 4.59. And then it again directs that a 10% rating is assigned where there is limitation of motion that is is non-compensable under the ratings. And so when you look at all of those regulations, which the VA has always had an obligation to apply all the laws, and it directs undebatably that a separate rating for his arthritis with limitation of motion should have been awarded. I also want to point out or highlight that there is no basis, no evidence whatsoever on what the VA understood these regulations to mean in 1971. The most we have, or the best we have, is in 1997, the VA states unequivocally that they're not aware of any prior policy and that the plain meaning of those regulations dictate separate ratings because they are separate disabilities. It's not a permissible reading. It's not we're going to, it could go either way, but we're going to go this way because we're supposed to be veteran-friendly. It is the plain meaning of those regulations require that they be assessed as separate disability. And the key word in all of this, which is overlooked and has been for a number of years by the VA, is disability is not the same as a joint, as a body part, as a diagnosis. A disability is under 4.59, painful motion of a joint. And a rating for that disability under Diagnostic Code 5003 is at least 10% where there's limitation of motion. Regarding harmless error, I would say that Mr. Percivali never got his day in court, so to say. The VA never got a chance to address his arguments. And I think that I would argue, be fundamentally unfair to reach any merits at this stage. However, we would again argue that it is undebatable that arthritis existed, that the limitation of motion existed, and that a clear, plain reading of the regulations requires that the VA assign separate disability for his for the arthritis with limitation of motion and the meniscus injury. And if there are no further questions, that is all we have. So again, we ask the court to reverse the board's ruling that there was no basis for Q and remand the matter back to address the merits of his argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank both parties very much for your arguments. The case is submitted for consideration, and court is adjourned, and the court will now come down and greet counsel.